Well, if you have your Bibles this morning, and I hope you do, would you open with me to the book of 1 Corinthians, please? We're going to be in 1 Corinthians 11 this morning. We're working our way through this thing pretty quick. We'll look at verses 2 through 16 today. If you look down at it, you're going to see that the subject matter that Paul is addressing is kind of strange, a little different. And so, you know, we'll get there in a minute, and we'll talk about that in a second. I'm excited to preach this passage. I love this text, and we'll get into that in a moment, but I'll start with something a little different. So, I didn't grow up, I've never been in a courtroom setting until a little over a year ago, I think. Don't worry, I wasn't the one in trouble, all right? I was there because of a jury thing, and but I'd never personally been part of something like that, and so I was just soaking it all in. Like, I'd watch Law and Order, I'd watch some, you know, courtroom dramas and stuff. My mom always watched Matlock every day of the week when I was growing up. So, like, anybody on Matlock when they were young? Okay, four of you, great. All right, so anyway, so like, I'd seen the courtroom thing, but I'd never been a part of it. And so let me ask you a question. If you're like me, you've probably seen a little bit of that. What is it? What are the two words that people use to address the judge in a courtroom? What are they? Your Honor, right? And they call the judge Your Honor because the judge is the one who is on top in the courtroom, right? His rules are, or her rules are, to be followed. That's the judge. They're on top in that room. And when those rules are not followed, he or she, the judge, calls for something. What do they say? There's going to be blank. What? Order. There's going to be order in this court. And the judge, the person who is the honorable one, gets to call for order because he or she is the one deserving honor in his courtroom. And so look, in that analogy, you and I exist in God's courtroom, okay? We exist in God's courtroom. And he reigns and he's on top and he will be honored. And the way that he is honored is when we recognize the order. Order in the court, right? The order that he expects from his creation. And when the creation is out of step with him as the honorable one, you know what he demands? Order. Be in order. Respond. Come back to order. And so this is the big idea this morning, all right? In our world that is so disorderly, so out of order, the big idea this morning is this, that God's honor in our world is being attacked because his created order is being attacked. And we honor God when we obey his order. We honor God when we obey his order. His honor is being attacked because his created order is being attacked, and we honor God when we obey his order. Now, there's a lot of different ways that we could see that, right? There's a lot of different ways that we could see. I can't see it back here, by the way. There's a lot of different ways that we could see God's order under attack, and we could literally pick any page of Scripture and say, yeah, there's a lot of sin here. There's a lot of problem of the fall here, right? But in our world, we can look a lot of different ways and see God's order being under attack. But as it pertains to our text this morning, there's just a few ways that I want to sort of dive in and apply that, okay? Because Paul does. Paul sees that God's order is under attack when it comes to marriage and family and sexuality, okay? Marriage, family, and sexuality, and so many other ways, right? But can I tell you something? As it pertains to all those categories and more than that, what God says goes, right? What God says goes. You've heard me say this before, but maybe you've heard, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. But with all due respect, it's a little bit short of the truth. Here's the truth. God said it. That settles it. Whether or not you believe it does not change the fact that God has settled it when he has said it, right? God said it, and that settles it. And so the way that we honor the Lord, the judge, the one who's on top, is through honoring the order that he has for his creation. Now check this out. When Paul writes this letter to the church in Corinth, it's a place in the Roman world. When he writes this letter to Corinth, he has in mind, again, when we're going to look at in chapter 11, the life of the church. Again, we can see that the world all around us is going to go one way, but God's church has to be the light of the world, the bride of Christ that is set apart, his assembly set apart, seeking to honor God by ordering ourselves. And so what Paul's going to do now, as we've been walking through this letter for some time, he's going to pivot from food sacrifice to idols and putting your brother first, which are all good things we talked about, but he's going to pivot now and address the way that Corinth gathers together. And he's going to do it specifically with one category today, and then next week we'll see other ways that he's addressing the way that God's church gathers. All right? So 1 Corinthians 11, look with me at verses 2 through 16. I'm going to read the whole thing, and then we'll come back, okay? You're going to have a lot of questions as I read this. It's a neat topic. We're going to talk about it. It says this. Now, I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I delivered them to you. But
I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it's the same as if her head were shaven. Four, if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That's why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so man now is now born of woman, and all things are from God. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a wife to pray with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory. For her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. Like I said, you read it and you think, well, I got lots and lots of questions. That was almost too much for me to take in at one time. And this is another thing that I've said several times. These little subheadings you see in our Bibles, right, above verse 2 in the ESV, which is what I preach from, it says head coverings. The passage talks about head coverings, but that's not really what the passage is about, okay? That's not really what the passage is about. What Paul is doing here is, again, addressing the church gathering. And by the way, worth noting, this is important. Worth noting is the first thing that Paul addresses in discussing a healthy church gathering. What's the first thing that he discusses? A healthy family culture, right? Healthy gathering of the church. First thing that he goes to is the healthy family dynamic, family culture. And he does this by not just addressing head coverings, but first and foremost, by addressing headship, okay? So before we talk about head coverings, we got to talk about headship. The head covering stuff will come in a moment, but let's talk about headship for a second. Look at me at verse 3. There's three categories that Paul's going to lay out, and I'll show you on the screen in a moment, but I want you to read verse 3 with me first. Three categories when he talks about headship, and we got to start here because this is sort of the bedrock. It's the foundation that his discussion on head coverings is going to stand, okay? He says, but I want you to understand, here it is, number one, that the head of every man is Christ. Two, that the head of a wife is her husband. And three, that the head of Christ is God. So when we use the word headship, what we mean by that is simply one that is placed in authority. Now, we don't live in an honor and shame culture, so this is a little bit lost on us. The first century AD in this context is very honor and shame driven. If shame was on you, then that was a big deal. If honor was on you, then that was a big deal in the social setting. And so it's a little bit lost on us. And so maybe a better word would be respect, right? As a husband, I know if there's not respect, and I know when I have respect, and that means something to me. Respect means something in our culture. And so what he does is, in talking about headship, he addresses this, and we got to address and understand what does headship mean before we can understand what head coverings mean, all right? So the three things, A, B, and C, let's hit them one at a time. The first one, A, is what does it mean for Christ to be the head of every man? And I'm going to say every person or every man because Christ is the head of not just the men in the room. He's also the head of the women in the room. Now, we'll talk about that in a moment. But he means here to say everybody, not just the males, but everybody. And certainly it's uniquely true of the men in the room. But what does it mean for Christ to be the head of every person, every man? Well, you'll see that again on the screen in just a second, but let me keep going for just a second, all right? I want you to look at a passage of scripture with me. You'll see it on the screen. Colossians 1:18. Colossians 1:18. And again, you'll see that on the screen again in just a second. Colossians 1:18 says, and he, that is Christ, Christ is the, everybody say it with me, head, right? Christ is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. The word preeminent means above everything, that he would be first. He is the head of the body, that is the church. This passage is talking about Jesus' headship. Now, here's a question for you, okay? We're God's church, and Christ is our head. Does everybody agree with that? Christ is the head of his church, okay? Now, here's my question for you. Does Christ's headship make him a tyrant over his church? Is Jesus a tyrant? No. Is he an abuser? No.
My point is that healthy biblical headship isn't tyranny, it's not domination, it's not abuse. What is healthy biblical headship? You'll see this on the screen now below. Is that biblical headship is marked by sacrifice and service. Biblical headship is marked by sacrifice and service. Jesus didn't come to his church and say, "You better cower before my feet and serve my every need," right? That's not biblical headship. If he's the head of his church, what did he do? Well, Mark 10:45 says, "The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." When Jesus was displaying his headship over the church in John chapter 13, you know what he was doing? He was on his hands and knees washing his disciples' feet. How does that sound for headship, right? That's what biblical headship looks like. In fact, just a few hours later, Jesus would be arrested for his church to serve his church, and then he would be crucified and bloodied and murdered because he wanted to lay his life down for those who were under his care. Jesus' headship wasn't marked by tyranny or abuse. Biblical headship is marked by sacrifice and service. So before we move to the second one, we need to agree biblically that biblical headship isn't domination, it's not tyrannical rule, and it's not abuse. It is selfless, sacrificial love for those under the care of the head. Okay? So as we go to the second one, letter B, that's a very important thing to remember. Letter B says this. What does it mean for the husband then to be the head of his wife? What does it mean for the husband then to be the head of his wife? Now remember, Jesus and his church is the picture we keep in mind, right? We know this because of Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians 5, 23 through 25 tells us that the relationship of Christ to his church is meant to be a picture of the relationship between husband and wife. And so what does husband headship look like? Well, you see it defined there in yellow on the screen. Husband headship defined, it is not the self-centered exercise of power. How do we know that? Because of Jesus, right? It's not the self-centered exercise of power, but instead it's selfless leadership that takes care to serve the spiritual, emotional, and physical needs of the wife. And I would add to that the family. This is healthy biblical headship. It's not self-centered exercise of power. It's laying down oneself and serving the spiritual, emotional, and physical needs of the wife and the family. It means that husbands, when you come home from work, dads, when you come home from work, your role is not to jump in the recliner, kick your feet up and say, "All right, wife and kids, bring me all of my needs. You exist to serve me." That is not biblical headship for a husband and a father. Instead, it's, "Okay, I'm home now. How can I serve you? How can I get to work? How can I put you first?" All right? It's the opposite of "you exist to serve me." Jesus came to put his life down on the line and say, "I'm here to serve you." And so husbands, if Ephesians 5 says that we are Jesus in that husband and wife relationship, comparatively, if that's the case, then what does it look like for you and me to be a biblical head of our family? It means to come not to be served, but to serve, right? So men, husbands, fathers, grade yourself by that standard. Not because it's our moral code, but because it's the order set forth by God and exemplified by Jesus. And again, if we dishonor the order of marriage that we see laid out for us, we dishonor the God who created it. It's not a matter of just getting your P's and Q's in order. Get your ducks in a row. No, what is it? It's I honor God when I honor his design, his order. Okay? All right. So third then is, what does it mean for the father to be the head of Christ? And again, it just compiles. You got A that leads to B, B then that leads to C. What does it mean for the father to be the head of Christ? This is very important because this is where we're going to dive into the bulk of this passage as it connects to the role of women and wives. And this is very important, okay? Because as I just talked about headship and leadership and authority as a husband to a wife, this next part is very, very important. You see what it says up there in yellow. It says this, that Jesus and the Father are equal in deity or their godness, but different in role and responsibility, okay? Equal in godness, different in role and responsibility. This is why Jesus submits to the will of his Father, even though they are equal, right? Jesus submitted to the will of his Father, even though, let me just ask you a question. Is Jesus less God than the Father? The answer is no. He is all of God made up in man, isn't he? He's 100% God, 100% man. So Jesus, in submitting to his Father, does that mean that he became less God? No, it does not even doesn't mean that, right? He's equal with the Father in essence, equal with the Father in deity, and yet he understands that his role is that of submission. A couple of examples of this. Think about the Garden of Gethsemane. It's the best example. The Garden of Gethsemane, in Mark 14, Jesus makes this plea and says, Lord, Father, let this cup pass from me. Like, this sounds terrible. What's about to happen is awful. And then in that prayer, he says, but not my will, but your will be done. What is that? That's submission, right? Equal in essence, equal in godness. And yet there is an order of submission and headship and authority. Jesus sought to honor his Father by honoring the order. I'll make it connect a little bit more. A lot of you in this room work outside the home, and you have probably a boss, right? And many of you have a boss. That boss is maybe more valuable than you to the company, okay? But he is not a being of greater value, is he or she? They are not of greater value than you on an entity level. That human being that you answer to isn't a greater level of human being than you are. What are you? You're equal. Equal in essence, equal in being. And yet, you know what you are? You're different in your roles and your responsibilities. And if you go and try to tell your boss, no, we're not, you're probably going to be looking for a job pretty soon, right? Because we understand equality of value and yet inequality in role and in submission and in authority. I say that to say this, and you'll see this on the screen behind me. Husbands and wives, like the Father and Jesus, are equal in being, equal in value, but we serve different roles. We serve different roles. The word for that is we're complementarian. That's what that viewpoint is. It means that we are equal in value, equal in essence. Men aren't greater than women, right? It's not that we put the patriarchy above. No. We're equal in value and essence, but we serve different roles in the home. And notice I'm not talking about men and women. I'm talking about husbands and wives, different roles in the home. We are called to submit to a head, more than one. It's not a matter of value, but of role. And it is God's order that we honor him through honoring his design. So, with that in mind, now, that's a huge, long setup. We're not going to spend as much time on the remaining verses, but we have to start there because the whole passage is built on understanding headship. Does that make sense? Does that make sense, everybody? A nod would just go a long way right now, okay? Does that make sense? Oh, great. You're so responsive. So look, with that in mind, how the equal but different roles of husbands and wives should influence our heart posture, there's two statements, very clear statements that we can make in light of what Paul's going to say next. Number one is this. Very clear. It sounds redundant, but this is it. Husbands should act like husbands, and wives should act like wives. Husbands should act like husbands, and wives should act like wives. In fact, this is the main thing that Paul is trying to say in this passage. Husbands should act like husbands, and wives should act like wives. He's going to do it through talking about head coverings, but this is the principle, all right? There's one more principle we'll talk about in just a moment. But remember, we're talking about the public setting. This is very important. Let me get your eyes for just a second. He's not speaking in generality. He's not talking about in the home. Paul is saying when you gather together, when the church comes together, there's some rules that you need to consider, okay? So as he's talking about the church gathering, we're going to take some broader principles from that, but let's address it as he is addressing it here. Look at verse 4. He says, every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. He's now going to talk about in verse 5, every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. Let me pause for just a second. When it says prays or prophesies, he's not talking about you at home in a prayer closet or at the dinner table or on your knees by your bedside. He's not talking about that praying and prophesying. Here's what, you know what praying means, but prophesying and praying, what he's talking about specifically is in the church gathering, there is a time, and by the way, the implication here is there's a time not just where women or men would pray or prophesy in the church, but that women also have a time where they are to pray and prophesy in the church. Now, we're going to talk about what that looks like in the weeks to come. I don't believe that it means that women serve as pastors or the ones that preach to God's congregation. But it does mean that there is an appropriate time where both men and women can say, hey, this is what I'm gleaning from the Word. Hey, this is what the Word says, and so we should celebrate that, okay? So like you guys, many of you just got back from Sunday school, and our Sunday school classes are men and women and boys and girls mixed together, right? And so there was a time maybe in your class where both a man or a woman said, I see this in this text, and I think that's pretty neat. You know what that's called? It's prophesying. That's saying, here's what the Word says, and here's how we live in light of that Word. That doesn't mean that that person is functioning as a pastor or as a teacher. It just means to say that there is a time, broad strokes, when men and women open their mouths and say, here's what the goodness of God's Word says. There's an appropriate time for that. Don't hear me say anything other than what I just said, okay? There's an appropriate time for that. And so what Paul's saying is, in that appropriate time, the head coverings thing is kind of important, okay? What he says is that men, every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. Now, listen, he ain't talking about their noggin, all right? He's saying their head, their spiritual head. And now he just said in verse 3 that the head of every man is Christ. So what he says is when a man covers his head, when he does that, he's dishonoring Christ. Now look, this is where we got to unplug ourselves from 21st century United States. Plug ourselves into 1st century AD Corinth. Because in their context, the pagans would do something where they would take their toga. They would take their toga and they would cover their head whenever they prayed to pagan gods. Okay? So what Paul says is, if you do that, you're dishonoring your God in heaven. Because you're not praying unto Jesus, you're praying like the pagans do. And so he said, men, you don't do that because you're dishonoring your head. Well, then he goes on and says in verse 5 and 6 something different. He says, but every wife who prays or prophesied with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it's the same as if her head were shaven. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. Now, again, this is not about a wife dishonoring her noggin. What's it about? Dishonoring her husband, her head, right? So this is about, be careful, wives. You don't want to dishonor your husband in the church gathering. Now, look, is Paul here saying that any woman who comes to church without a veil on her head is in sin? Of course not. Of course not. The culture is vital in understanding this passage because this is Rome. By the way, this is not just Rome and not America. This is Rome and not Israel. This isn't even a Middle Eastern context. This is a Roman context. And in the Roman context, here's the way it was. Men had short hair, and if they didn't, it meant something. And women had long hair, and if they didn't, it meant something. In their little society, in their culture, those things meant something. You ever heard of the Caesar haircut? You ever heard of that before? Come on, y'all. You ever heard of the Caesar haircut? Okay, well, I have. The Caesar haircut is a short haircut. Where do you think that haircut came from? The time period of Caesar, right? And so it was the common haircut. If you go see statues from this time period in the Roman Empire, they got the same haircut because this was the haircut of the Roman Empire. Men had hair that was cut short like this. Now listen, hold on a second. Think about the Middle Eastern context. In all likelihood, did Jesus have short hair or long hair? Most likely he had long hair, okay? In fact, most Middle Eastern men had long hair. Now look, it says here that if a man has long hair, it's dishonorable. Does that mean that Jesus was dishonorable? Of course not. Of course not. And that's the point, is that we have to understand that there's a cultural statement that's being made by Paul here. And the statement is not that it's sinful to have short hair versus long hair. What's he trying to say? Well, in this context, a woman that had long hair uncovered in public, it meant something. You know what it meant? It meant sexual availability. That's what it meant. So if you were at church and this woman had her hair uncovered, you know what she was saying to everybody around? I'm available. And if someone was married and saying that, do you see how that may be an issue? Husbands, if your wife was at church and she was kind of talking to people and saying, hey, I'm around, I'm available, what would that make you feel like? Dishonored, which is exactly what Paul's saying. There was a way to physically communicate that. And the wives that were doing that were wrong. They were in sin. not because it was sinful to have long hair exposed, but because it was sinful to communicate to your husbands or anybody else, I'm available. Does that make sense? So this is what Paul is speaking to. A married woman shouldn't show up and say with her body, come flirt with me, right? You're dishonoring your husband. In fact, he says also they can't shave their head because in their context it meant I want to be a man, or maybe it meant I'm an adulterer. And so that also dishonored their husband. So the question then is, bring it full circle. So should women in America wear head coverings or not shave their heads? And of course the answer to that question is, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because in our culture and our context, we don't have the same societal rules as first century Corinth did. Because in our culture, a head covering or a shaved head are not the things that communicate a message of honor or dishonor to one's husband. However, there are things in our culture that communicate honor or dishonor to one's husband. So what we should take from this is, wives, you should be very aware of what those things are and not do them. Like what? Well, dress like you're married. Dress modestly. Don't be giving an invitation to people just by the way that you are making your physical appearance seem. Also, we have this thing in our culture that communicates, I'm not available, right? A wedding band, okay? And so we should wear our wedding bands, husbands and wives, and he's talking about wives here, but we should wear our wedding bands. Why? Because it communicates, I'm not available. I belong to someone. And this is a very small, literally a small way, but a big way, to communicate, I honor my spouse, okay? In other ways, don't be a flirt. Don't be promiscuous. These are things that honor your head. And this is what Paul is getting at. Head coverings is just a variable in the context, but it's a very important principle that wives, you honor your head. The same thing for us. We should honor our head, which is Christ. All right, 7 through 10. He says, for a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. Now, before you go thinking that that makes it seem like men are more valuable, we're going to get to a verse in a minute that totally puts that to bed. Same author here, right? For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. And what he's saying here is, God created Adam from the dust. We see this in Genesis 2, but it says that God created Eve out of Adam, out of his rib, right? So literally, man was created just ground up by God, but woman was created from man. Verse 9, neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. And he's referencing here that Adam needed a helper, and so God gave him a helper, which was Eve. That is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Now, I'm just going to be honest with you, and I think it's good that you hear a pastor say this sometimes. I have no idea what that means. I have no idea what that means, and really no one has any idea what that means. In some way, the messengers of God, which are angels, are spectating, and it is very important to God that they see that his creation honors the Creator. Why that is, I don't know. Well, let's ask him one day. How about that? What it means, I'm not really sure beyond that. But clearly what Paul's point is here is to reference Genesis 2 at length. Eve was literally formed from Adam, his rib, and therefore her existence is a reflection of the glory of man. Now again, that doesn't mean that she herself doesn't have glory. We're going to see this in the next couple of verses. But God looked at Adam and said, it's not good for this guy to be alone. And so he created a helper. We have head and we have helper. The point is that God has designed that the husband should lead the wife, not as a power-driven tyrant, but as a Christ-like head of servant leadership. And so look, there's two things at work here. Men, you and I have a calling as husbands and dads. And women, you have a calling as wives. Now, if none of those apply to you, we're going to get to a broader application in a moment. But before we do that, men, our high calling is to glorify God as a husband. And so we need to drop the anchor there for just a moment. I need you to understand something. I heard this from our couple small group a few weeks ago, and I want to remind you of it today. You need to remember who your father-in-law is. My point is, before she's your wife, she's God's daughter. Before she's your wife, she's God's daughter. And you honor God by ordering your life correctly as a husband. And the opposite is true. You dishonor God when you don't order your life as a husband. What does that mean? Guys, here's what it means. You and I need to lead our families spiritually. You are the spiritual leader in your home. You're the spiritual leader in your home. It means that your role as a husband and as a father is not just to put bread on the table. It's not just to bring home the paycheck. It's not just that. Your best and biggest role in the home is to be the spiritual leader in your home. What does that look like? It means lots of things. I'll give you a quick list. It means doing things like praying with your family, praying with your wife. Pray together. It means encouraging her spiritual growth. It means to consider her needs as your own. It means to make church involvement a priority. Again, in the immediate context, this is talking about the church gathering. And so you know what it means, guys? Husbands, listen. Dads, listen. This is what it means. It means that you need to act like husbands and fathers when you gather with the church. When you gather with the church. The first big thing is that husbands should act like husbands and wives should act like wives. Guys, you need to lead them here, but then to lead them while you're here, okay? Lead them to come to church, but don't just then stand back and cross your arms, you know? No, you need to lead them as husband and as dad while you are here. You know one way that you can do that? This means that while we are singing and praise and worship music is being sung, you know what you're not doing? Standing there with your mouth closed. Because you need to teach your wife, teach your children that God is worthy of the words that come out of your mouth. And sing. You can lead your family by singing the praises of God. All of our worship service, we pass offering plates and we give. I want my kids to see a check go in the offering plate. Not to try to prove something, but to teach them something. You know what it is? That God is worth our resources. You lead them by showing them that. As we pray, participate. Even now, you know how you can lead your family, even right now, husbands and fathers? By listening, by taking in the word, and taking seriously the preaching of the word. You lead them through that. When there's an opportunity to serve in the church, you serve in the church. Why? Because God's worth it, yes. But because you need to be the spiritual leader in your home that says, we serve because we have been served. This is husband headship. Wives, it also means that you glorify God in honoring your husbands as his wife. Again, husbands act like husbands, but wives act like wives. What does this look like for as a wife to honor your head? Again, there's lots and lots of answers to this question. And maybe I'm not the best person to answer them. Go join one of our ladies' small groups. They're trying to figure this thing out as they go and do life together. But I can think of a few ways. Listen, as it pertains to your husband, encourage him. You should be his number one encourager. Encourage your husband. Try to build him up. Accept that he isn't perfect. Accept that he needs Jesus. Accept that. Offer grace. But expect growth. That should be an expectation of yours. And let God be the enforcer of his discipleship. Don't belittle him, but speak well of him. Love him well. Value him. And yes, be intimate with him. That's how you get to his heart. Pray for him. And by the way, tell him that you pray for him. These are ways that you put the head and say, I'm going to honor him. Honor the person that God has given me. Husbands should act like husbands. And wives should act like wives. Now he goes more broad. And so the second thing, if you're taking notes, is this. That men should act like men and women should act like women. Sounds redundant, doesn't it? Not in our culture, right? Men should act like men and women should act like women. Maybe for a long time this didn't need to be said in our context, but it certainly needs to be said today. So what we see is that Paul affirms different but equal. We've already seen that. He's going to kind of lean into this more. Again, before you go thinking, he seems like he's valuing men over women. No, in verse 11, he kind of puts that to bed. He says, nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man nor man of woman. For as woman was made from man, so now man is now born of woman. And all things are from God. He's not saying one is a slave and one is a tyrant. The two were made one flesh. They're the same and yet different. And so finally he lands on, so look, you be the judge. Is what I'm saying crazy? In verse 13, that's what he says. Judge yourselves. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Is it proper for a wife to dishonor her husband? Just think for a second. Judge for yourselves. Is that a good thing for a wife to dishonor her husband? Look at verses 13 through 15. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself, that's an important word,
Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it's a disgrace for him, but if a woman has long hair, it's her glory, for her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. What Paul's saying here is examine what is natural among you. Here's what's natural among us. Okay, I'll just listen for just a second. Listen, man. Men and women are different. Men and women are different. Men should act like men, and women should act like women. Men and women are different. God, he appeals to nature because he's saying, isn't it obvious that men and women are created differently? And again, there may have been a time that I wouldn't feel like I had to say that, but in our culture and context, that's something that needs to be said. Men and women are different. God created us differently. And what he's trying to get at is men should act like men and women should act like women. My brother-in-law, I wanted to tell you too, my sister and my brother-in-law are here in the States. I can't talk about why that's significant from the stage while we're broadcasting, but many of you know why that's significant. They're here in the States, and they'll be here for a couple of months. Excited about that. I'm probably going to get them over here to give us a word of testimony and encouragement at some point. So looking forward to that. Anyway, my brother-in-law has long, flowing locks. Yeah. He's got just long, dark, beautiful hair. I spoke at their wedding for just a few moments, and I'm obviously my sister's brother, and I acted like her brother on the stage, you know. And I remember saying at their wedding that it's okay that his hair is nicer than hers. I said that on their wedding day, you know. When she has all this time to fix her hair up, I said, man, your hair looks great today. That's what I said. I'm her brother. What am I going to do, right? But here's what I want to tell you. I have never thought that he looked feminine or was trying to blur the lines, okay? I've never thought that him with his long, nice hair was trying to look feminine. I never thought to myself, oh, he's blurring the line. Many of you ladies in our culture have shorter hair without femininity being cast aside. Paul is trying to make a cultural point, okay? And in their culture, these two things meant something. But in our culture, a man can have long hair and not question for a second his masculinity. And a woman can have short hair and not question for a second her femininity. What's my point? God created men to be manly, and he created women to cherish their feminine beauty. And however that is appropriately displayed, we should do that for the honor of your spouse, the honor of God's order, and the honor of God himself. And please listen to this. Men, to not embrace your masculinity, or women, for you to not embrace your feminine beauty is to dishonor the order of the designer. And this is why, please listen, this is why so-called transgenderism is such a blatant disregard and dishonor toward God's design. Just call it like it is. That doesn't mean that I'm being a hater. It doesn't mean that I'm bigoted. I'm simply saying God created us to be one way, and for us to say, no, you did it wrong, is a blatant dishonor to the one who made us a certain way. Psalm 139, verse 14 says this, I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. What do you see there? Honor, I praise you. Order, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Guys, transgenderism, I'm born in the wrong body, or whatever you want to say, that is rooted in envy. It's wanting something that God did not create for you to be. It's a first commandment issue, no other gods. And church, if we lose order, we lose honor. And yes, please listen, man, we should love our neighbors. But if loving your neighbor means embracing disorder, then that is not real love. As God designed it. You have a love that far exceeds all other loves, and that is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And this isn't contentious. There's no arguing that. That is a profound and wonderful truth. And the reason I say that word contentious is because of the very next thing. It's almost like Paul knows that he said something that is kind of a little bit shaky to people. Because the next thing he says in verse 16 is, look, if anyone is inclined to be contentious about that, is what he's saying. If anyone's inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. In other words, he's saying, the case is closed on this. Husbands should act like husbands.
Wives should act like wives. Men should act like men. Women should act like women. And the case is closed. Guys, Jesus is our collective head. And as I said earlier, we got stuff for husbands, we got stuff for wives, men and women. And you may be thinking, I feel kind of lost in all this. Here's what I want you to leave with this morning. That at the end of the day, it doesn't matter who you are in this room. You and I have been given a head, and his name is Jesus. Christ is the head of his church. And so what are you and I to do? You and I are to order our lives, not just because we want to adhere to a moral code, not just because we want to be good religious people. Why do we order our lives? Because we honor the judge. Because we honor him in all things. So husbands, wives, men, women, children, students, workers, bosses, all of you, are you living a life that honors your head, Christ, in all that you do? And remember the great, wonderful thing about our head. In a world where we hear the word authority and we kind of get a bad taste in our mouths, we do that because we don't trust authority. People abuse it. And in a world where that mentality may come to mind, be reminded that Jesus is the greatest possible authority that we could possibly be given. You know why? Because the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. He laid his life down so that you would offer your life to him. What we're about to do right here, this Lord's Supper. You know what's great? It's weird. I talked to Pastor Chris earlier. I was like, man, we kind of missed it. Because next week, Paul literally talks about the Lord's Supper. And the week before, which was last week, we talked about food sacrificed to idols. And we talked about the Lord's table. And then we got this week, head coverings. And we're taking Lord's Supper. Bad planning, right? But can I tell you something wonderful? Every single passage in your Bible points to this right here. Every single one. Because you know what biblical headship is all about? Laying down one's life for the good of those in its care. Guys, that is the Lord's Supper. Where Jesus didn't just come as the king, he also came as the lamb. And so today, my prayer for you is that you would give your life to Jesus and make him the head of your life.